Certainly, not otherwise. They were a balcony full of gentlemen overlooking a bright and busy square, but he felt no more safe with them than if they had been a boat full of armed pirates overlooking an empty sea. There was a second thought that never came to him. It never occurred to him to be spiritually won over to the enemy. Many moderns, inured to a weak worship of intellect and force, might have wavered in their allegiance under this oppression of a great personality. They might have called Sunday the Superman. If any such creature be conceivable, he looked, indeed, somewhat like it, with his earth-shaking abstraction, as of a stone statue walking. He might have been called something above man, with his large plans, which were too obvious to be detected, with his large face, which was too frank to be understood. But this was a kind of modern meanness to which Syme could not sink, even in his extreme morbidity. Like any man, he was coward enough to fear great force, but he was not quite coward enough to admire it. The men were eating as they talked, and even in this they were typical. Dr. Bull and the Marquis ate casually and conventionally of the best things on the table, cold pheasant or Strasbourg pie. But the secretary was a vegetarian, and he spoke earnestly of the projected murder over half a raw tomato and three-quarters of a glass of tepid water. The old professor had such slops as suggested a sickening second childhood, and even in this President Sunday preserved his curious predominance of mere mass, for he ate like 20 men. He ate incredibly, with a frightful freshness of appetite, so that it was like watching a sausage factory. Yet continually, when he had swallowed a dozen crumpets or drunk a quart of coffee, he would be found with his great head on one side, staring at Syme. "I have often wondered," said the Marquis, taking a great bite out of a slice of bread and jam, "whether it wouldn't be better for me to do it with a knife. Most of the best things have been brought off with a knife, and it would be a new emotion to get a knife into a French president and rail it around." "You are wrong," said the secretary, drawing his black brows together. "The knife was merely the expression of the old personal quarrel with a personal tyrant. Dynamite is not only our best tool, but our best symbol. It is as perfect a symbol of us as is incense of the prayers of the Christians. It expands. It only destroys because it broadens. Even so, thought only destroys because it broadens. A man's brain is a bomb," he cried out, loosening suddenly his strange passion and striking his own skull with violence. "My brain feels like a bomb, night and day. It must expand. It must expand. A man's brain must expand if it breaks up the universe." "I don't want the universe broken up just yet," drawled the Marquis. "I want to do a lot of beastly things before I die. I thought of one yesterday in bed." "No, if the only end of the thing is nothing," said Dr. Bull, with his sphinx-like smile, "it hardly seems worth doing." The old professor was staring at the ceiling with dull eyes. "Every man knows in his heart," he said, "that nothing is worth doing." There was a singular silence, and then the secretary said, "We are wandering, however, from the point. The only question is how Wednesday is to strike the blow. I take it we should all agree with the original notion of a bomb. As to the actual arrangements, I should suggest that tomorrow morning he should go first of all to..." The speech was broken off short under a vast shadow. President Sunday had risen to his feet, seeming to fill the sky above them. "Before we discuss that," he said in a small, quiet voice, "let us go into a private room. I have something vent particular to say." Syme stood up before any of the others. The instant of choice had come at last. The pistol was at his head. On the pavement, before he could hear the policeman idly stir and stamp, for the morning, though bright, was cold. A barrel organ in the street suddenly sprang with a jerk into a jovial tune. Syme stood up taut, as if it had been a bugle before the battle. He found himself filled with a supernatural courage that came from nowhere. That jingling music seemed full of the vivacity, the vulgarity, and the irrational valor of the poor, who in all those unclean streets were all clinging to the decencies and the charities of Christendom. His youthful prank of being a policeman had faded from his mind. He did not think of himself as the representative of the corps of gentlemen turned into fancy constables, or of the old eccentric who lived in the dark room. But he did feel himself as the ambassador of all these common and kindly people in the street, who every day marched into battle to the music of the barrel organ. And this high pride in being human had lifted him unaccountably to an infinite height above the monstrous men around him. For an instant, at least, he looked down upon all their sprawling eccentricities from the starry pinnacle of the commonplace. He felt towards them all that unconscious and elementary superiority that a brave man feels over powerful beasts or a wise man over powerful errors. He knew that he had neither the intellectual nor the physical strength of President Sunday, but in that moment he minded it no more than the fact that he had not the muscles of a tiger or a horn on his nose like a rhinoceros. All was swallowed up in an ultimate certainty that the president was wrong, and that the barrel organ was right. There clanged in his mind that unanswerable and terrible truism in the Song of Roland. Reader's note, I'm going to spell this. PANESONTTORTETCHRZTINSONTDROIT, which in the old nasal French has the clang and groan of great iron. This liberation of his spirit from the load of his weakness went with a quite clear decision to embrace death. If the people of the barrel organ could keep their old world obligations, so could he. This very pride in keeping his word was that he was keeping it to miscreants. It was his last triumph over these lunatics to go down into their dark room and die for something that they could not even understand. The barrel organ seemed to give the marching tune with the energy and the mingled noises of the whole orchestra, and he could hear deep and rolling under all the trumpets of the pride of life, the drums of the pride of death. The conspirators were already filing through the open window and into the rooms behind. Syme went last, outwardly calm, but with all his brain and body throbbing with romantic rhythm. The president led them down an irregular side stair such as might be used by servants, and in a dim, cold, empty room with a table and benches like an abandoned boardroom. When they were all in, he closed and locked the door. The first to speak was Gogol, the irreconcilable, who seemed bursting with inarticulate grievance. "Josio," he cried, with an obscure excitement, his heavy Polish accent becoming almost impenetrable. "You said you not I'd. You say you show himself. It is all nothings. When you want talk importance, you run yourself in a dark box." The president seemed to take the foreigner's incoherent satire with entire good humor. "You can't get hold of it yet, Gogol," he said in a fatherly way. "When once they have heard us talking nonsense on that balcony, they will not care where we go afterwards. If we had come here first, we should have had the whole staff at the keyhole. You don't seem to know anything about mankind." "I die for them," cried the Pole in thick excitement, "and I slay their oppressors. I care not for these games of concealment. I would smite the tyrant in the open square." I see," said the president, nodding kindly as he seated himself at the top of a long table. "You die for mankind first, and then you get up and smite their oppressors. So that's all right. And now may I ask you to control your beautiful sentiments and sit down with the other gentlemen at this table. For the first time this morning, something intelligent is going to be said." Syme, with the perturbed promptitude he had shown since the original summons, sat down first. Gogol sat down last, grumbling in his brown beard about gombromise. No one except Symes seemed to have any notion of the blow that was about to fall. As for him, he had merely the feeling of a man mounting the scaffold with the intention, at any rate, of making a good speech. "Comrades," said the president, suddenly rising, "we have spun out this farce long enough. I have called you down here to tell you something so simple and shocking that even the waiters upstairs, long inured to our levities, might hear some new seriousness in my voice. Comrades, we were discussing plans and naming places. I propose, before saying anything else, that those plans and places should not be voted by this meeting, but should be left wholly in the control of some one reliable member. I suggest Comrade Saturday, Dr. Bull." They all stared at him. Then they all started in their seats, for the next words, though not loud, had a living and sensational emphasis. Sunday struck the table. "Not one word more about the plans and places must be said at this meeting. Not one tiny detail more about what we mean to do must be mentioned in this company." Sunday had spent his life in astonishing his followers, but it seemed as if he had never really astonished them until now. They all moved feverishly in their seats except Symes. He sat stiff in his with his hand in his pocket and on the handle of his loaded revolver. When the attack on him came, he would sell his life dear. He would find out at least if the president was mortal. Sunday went on smoothly. "You will probably understand that there is only one possible motive for forbidding free speech at this festival of freedom. Strangers overhearing us matters nothing. They assume that we are joking. But what would matter, even unto death, is this, that there should be one actually among us who is not of us, who knows our grave purpose, but does not share it, who..." The secretary screamed out suddenly like a woman. "It can't be," he cried, leaping. "There can't." The president flapped his large flat hand on the table like the fin of some huge fish. "Yes," he said slowly, "there is a spy in this room. There is a traitor at this table. I will waste no more words. His name..." Symes half rose from his seat, his finger firm on the trigger. "His name is Gogol," said the president. "He is that hairy humbug over there who pretends to be a Pole." Gogol sprang to his feet, a pistol in each hand. With the same flash, three men sprang at his throat. Even the professor made an effort to rise. But Symes saw little of the scene, for he was blinded with the beneficent darkness. He had sunk down into his seat, shuddering, in a palsy of passionate relief. Chapter 7. The Unaccountable Conduct of Professor De Worms. "Sit down," said Sunday in a voice that he used once or twice in his life, a voice that made men drop drawn swords. The three who had risen fell away from Gogol and that equivocal person himself resumed his seat. "Well, my man," said the president briskly, addressing him as one addresses a total stranger, "will you oblige me by putting your hand in your upper waistcoat pocket and showing me what you have there?" The alleged Pole was a little pale under his tangle of dark hair, but he put two fingers into the pocket with apparent coolness and pulled out a blue strip of card. When Symes saw it lying on the table, he woke up again to the world outside him. For although the card lay at the other extreme end of the table, and he could read nothing of the inscription on it, it bore a startling resemblance to the blue card in his own pocket, the card which had been given to him when he joined the anti-anarchist constabulary. "Pathetic Slav," said the president, "tragic child of Poland, are you prepared in the presence of that card to deny that you are in this company? Shall we say, die Trop?" "Right-o," said the late Gogol. It made everyone jump to hear a clear, commercial, and somewhat cockney voice coming out of that forest of foreign hair. It was irrational, as if a Chinaman had suddenly spoken with a Scotch accent. "I gather that you fully understand your position," said Sunday. "You bet," answered the Pole. "I see it's a fair cop. All I say is I don't believe any Pole could have imitated my accent like I did his. I concede the point, said Sunday. I believe your own accent to be inevitable, though I shall practice it in my bath. Do you mind leaving your beard with your card? Not a bit, answered Gogol, and with one finger he ripped off the whole of his shaggy head covering, emerging with thin red hair and a pale, pert face. It was hot, he added. I will do you the justice to say, said Sunday, not without a sort of brutal admiration, that you seem to have kept pretty cool under it. Now listen to me. I like you. The consequence is that it would annoy me for just about 2.5 minutes if I heard that you had died in torments. Well, if you ever tell the police or any human soul about us, I shall have that 2.5 minutes of discomfort. On your discomfort, I will not dwell. Good day. Mind the step. The red-haired detective who had masqueraded as Gogol rose to his feet without a word and walked out of the room with an air of perfect nonchalance. Yet the astonished Syme was able to realize that this ease was suddenly assumed, for there was a slight stumble outside the door, which showed that the departing detective had not minded the step. Time is flying, said the president in his gayest manner after glancing at his watch, which, like everything about him, seemed bigger than it ought to be. I must go off at once. I have to take the chair at a humanitarian meeting. The secretary turned to him with working eyebrows. Would it not be better, he said a little sharply, to discuss further the details of our project now that the spy has left us? No, I think not, said the president with a yawn like an unobtrusive earthquake. Leave it as it is. Let Saturday settle it. I must be off. Breakfast here next Sunday. But the late loud scenes had whipped up the most naked nerves of the secretary. He was one of those men who are conscientious even in crime. I must protest, President, that the thing is irregular, he said. It is a fundamental rule of our society that all plans shall be debated in full council. Of course, I fully appreciate your forethought when in the actual presence of a traitor. Secretary, said the president seriously, if you'd take your head home and boil it for a turnip, it might be useful. I can't say, but it might. The secretary reared back in a kind of equine anger. I really fail to understand, he began in high offense. That's it, said the president, nodding a great many times. That's where you fail, right enough. You fail to understand. Why, you dancing donkey, he roared, rising. You didn't want to be overheard by a spy, didn't you? How do you know you aren't overheard now? And with these words, he shouldered his way out of the room, shaking with incomprehensible scorn. Four of the men left behind gaped after him without any apparent glimmering of his meaning. Syme alone had even a glimmering, and such as it was, it froze him to the bone. If the last words of the president meant anything, they meant that he had not, after all, passed unsuspected. They meant that while Sunday could not denounce him like Gogol, he still could not trust him like the others. The other four got to their feet, grumbling more or less, and betook themselves elsewhere to find lunch, for it was already well past midday. The professor went last, very slowly and painfully. Syme sat long after the rest had gone, revolving his strange position. He had escaped a thunderbolt, but he was still under a cloud. At last he rose and made his way out of the hotel into Leicester Square. The bright, cold day had grown increasingly colder, and when he came out into the street he was surprised by a few flakes of snow. While he still carried the sword stick and the rest of Gregory's portable luggage, he had thrown the cloak down and left it somewhere, perhaps on the steam tug, perhaps on the balcony. Hoping, therefore, that the snow shower might be slight, he stepped back out of the street for a moment and stood up under the doorway of a small and greasy hairdresser's shop, the front window of which was empty, except for a sickly, wax lady in evening dress. Snow, however, began to thicken and fall fast, and Syme, having found one glance at the wax lady quite sufficient to depress his spirits, stared out instead into the white and empty street. He was considerably astonished to see, standing quite still outside the shop and staring into the window, a man. His top hat was loaded with snow like the hat of Father Christmas,